Hey, Zobe, you rolling?
Yeah.
You know, I've been thinking about recording one of those grooves, you know, that my mom used to love. You know, one of those easy kind of things.
Yeah.
Check this out.
Well, good afternoon, everyone. This is Leroy Downs on Sounds and Colors Radio.
Now, that's what I'm talking about.
Today with Mr. George Duke. Hey, George.
Hey, man, what's happening?
What's going on, brother?
Oh, man, I'm trying to live in your world. You the man with the plan.
Oh, no, man, I got the second plan. I got my first plan from you.
Yeah, right. How have you been?
I've been well, man. Yourself?
Good. I'm hanging in there for an old guy.
Yeah.
Can't complain.
Well, good, man. You got a gig coming up here at the Playboy Jazz Festival, which is pretty much literally your backyard. I mean...
Yeah, I could walk down there.
Yeah, exactly. I would imagine it's probably one of the stages that you would most call home. I mean, through the years, you played at Playboy so many times. Can you reminisce on some of those great moments?
Oh, my goodness. I can remember being back there way back in the days. I mean, I've got pictures with me with Count Basie and Joe Williams, and I mean, going back that far. You know, and other things. Obviously, the Bill Cosby era, which was a very important one, at least for me, when I was there working with Stanley Clarke or my own band or whatever. And I've done some things there with Nat Adderley, you know, when they had their little tribute to Nat. And so there have been a lot of occasions that I've appeared at the festival, not only at the festival, but at the Bowl in general. So it is like my backyard, a big backyard. And, of course, the Playboy Festival is just a big party. So if somebody's coming there to expect to hear Beethoven, they ain't going to hear it. You know, I mean, even Beethoven with a jazz beat, that is not kind of what the Playboy Festival is about. It's a party, it's a family atmosphere, and you know, music has many purposes, and the Playboy satisfies one of those, and which is just for enjoyment, and you come out with family and friends and have a good time.
Yeah, you know, one sound that certainly people rise to the occasion on is when you get together with your old partner, Stanley Clarke.
Yeah, Stanley is a good buddy of mine. He's not involved with this particular gig, but we have done the Playboy many times in the past together. And on this occasion, I bring Jeffrey Osborne with me, not for any particular reason other than the fact that he's a great singer. And we don't have a lot of time, but you know, there are a lot of acts on the bill. But I always have fun with Jeffrey because he's the consummate professional and knows how to use his voice. And we're going to put on a good show.
Well, you know, you've produced so many musicians over the years, man. The style, the different genres, I guess it all really depends on who you're working with. But the question is not how you feel about music, but how do you think about music? Do you think by form, composition, idea, development, genre? Is it goal-oriented? I mean, what are some of your feelings about sound and the dynamics of it?
Well, you know, music to me is like an open canvas. It's like looking at a sonic canvas that's just clear and there's nothing on it. And it's up to me to paint something on it and to bring something alive, to weave some kind of idea into that fabric, you know. And that's why I call my new album Dreamweaver, because that's really what artists are. We take something from nothing and make something of that, you know. It's just, I mean, it could be, for us, it's sonic, it's audio. But it's the same thing as weaving a design and weaving a fabric. And, of course, the deeper that fabric goes, you know, the better it is in general. And so it's an open canvas. In terms of style, style is irrelevant. It's got nothing to do with that. All it has to do with is music. If an artist has the ability to play a certain genre, I don't see why they shouldn't be able to do it. For me, you know, and I think most people know this who know, as eclectic as I am, I give with as great of respect to Miles Davis, as to Stravinsky, as to Parliament Funkadelic. So music has different purposes, and it serves different purposes, and that's the way I look at it. So I'm not, but I wasn't always like that. And I understand people who are very rigid in terms of what they believe. I understand that as well, but they got to understand me too. Hello.
Well, well, you're George, man. You're all over the map with the music, which is beautiful. But you know, I used to be pretty rigid about the music myself, but I've opened up because there's so many different elements to the music. But what about the audience that seems to put a glass ceiling on sound? I mean, how do we open them up to sound?
Well, you know, people are entitled to believe what they want. They're entitled to love and digest what they will. I think that's okay. I got no problem with it, because music is so powerful in a strange way without actually touching people physically. It's almost by osmosis. It gets in there and works in people's lives and becomes like almost the sonic biography of their lives. It's the soundtrack to various experiences in their lives, and it's just an interesting and powerful thing. And so I respect that, because I know what certain songs of mine from the past, say 30, 40 years ago, means to certain people, and they don't understand what I'm doing now, you know, which is okay. But I try to, in terms of how do you do it? For me, on one show, I'll play it. I will not play down. No matter whether I'm playing funk, R&B, jazz, straight ahead jazz, whatever, I will not play down to an audience. I mean, I play what I know how to play. And it all comes from a central source, you know, what I call the ancient source. I won't get too deep on you now, but it's basically from me. This whole music experience comes from one place, and as long as it's honestly presented, you ain't got nothing to worry about.
Man, that's the key word right there, brother. Honesty, for sure. You know, there's so many avenues to discover music, and what I don't think people realize is that these are the roads that lead to yourself. You know, they help you discover things about yourself. And So I got to take a quick second to say that you in particular, George Duke, were the beginning of my dream, man, because it was coming over your house 35 years ago and looking at all that equipment, just wanted me to be a part of the music in some sort of way, man. So definitely want to say thank you for that.
All right. It's all an experience.
Yes, it is. Now, one of the things that I didn't get a chance to experience was Cannon and Frank Zappa. I mean, you know me, I've traveled the straight ahead path, and usually I'm on the progressive road now. But, you know, back in the day, you played with Cannonball, and I know about Cannon, but I don't really know much about Frank Zappa. What can you tell me a bit about both of those characters?
Well, I kind of work with them very close together. And Frank, for me, was a little bit of an eye-opener, because I was, like you, at that time when I joined Frank Zappa, I was a straight-ahead jazz guy. I could hear nothing else but Bud Powell and Miles of the Day, you know, Train, whatever. That's really all I knew. Other than the gospel music that I played in the church, you know, I kind of mixed those two together. But my eyes were on East Coast jazz. That's what I heard, what I loved. And when I joined Frank, he kind of opened me up to other forms of music, and essentially would sit me down and say, look, you need to open yourself up to the wide world of music and what it is. And you don't have to like it all. Just if there's something there that you like and you want to include in your arsenal, use it. It's there for you to use. It's like an open smorgasbord, like it's an open house. Every little bit of food is there, and style of food. You just grab what you want, put it on your plate, and eat what you will. And so, you know, I began to do that. I began to see the value in simpler forms of music, which is what he taught me in a very crude way, you know, because, you know, he told me either I played a certain way or I could leave. You know, he was very, very strong and adamant about it. And you know, there's so many things that he taught me that allow my humor to come out. He's the first one that encouraged me to sing. The first one that encouraged me to play synthesizers. He would say, George, you should play synthesizer. And I said, I should, you know. And, of course, then once I found my voice on that and found out that you could bend a note, all I wanted to do on synthesizer back in those days was play like Yusef Lateef played the flute.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's kind of a Miles Davis approach of sorts. And speaking about Miles, I mean, there's so many different eras of Miles that people were inspired by. Which era, or how many eras I should say, may have inspired you and helped you enhance your creativity?
At least five.
Wow. Yeah.
I mean, through the years, I think Miles has changed the direction of music. I mean, I can count at least five times, maybe more. And for me, it changed my direction of music. I mean, the first record I heard of Miles was the Kind of Blue album, which blew me away. I mean, and every musician on the record, from Philly Joe Jones to, you know, everybody was on the Cannonball, Train, all of them. And little did I know at that time that I would actually be able to work with Cannonball after that. Bill Evans, Wynton Kelly, those were all, that was all my thing. you know, and all those Miles records that followed that, you know, whether it be Cooking with the Miles Davis Quintet, Relaxing with the Miles Davis Quintet, that affected me right on into his more electric stuff, to when he got together with Herbie and Wayne Shorter and all of that, started doing that kind of music with Tony Williams. All that, man, I kept seeing him change, and I mean change drastically. And all of me, as soon as he would do something, all the other musicians would kind of follow. So I said, well, shoot, if he can do it, why can't I do it? You know, when he started getting into what Sly was doing, I said, well, ain't that something? And then all of it, and the whole Jimi Hendrix thing, and then the whole, it was just, Miles was, he wore different clothes, but underneath, he was still Miles. And when I got a chance to actually work and produce with him on A Mandolin and the Tutu album, that was like a joy of my life, man. To have Miles call me on the phone and say, hey, George. I said, yeah. He said, hey, man, I want you to write me something. I mean, that was a trip. I was like, I thought it was Stanley Clarke. I said, man, quit playing. But it was Miles. Man, this ain't no Stanley. This is Miles, man. Hey, man, I want you to write me a tune. Serious business. That's how it happened.
That's an honor.
Yeah.
Honor indeed. Well, you know, everybody that you just got through mentioning, you talk about the music and you're talking about some real musicians, you know, and back in the day, listening and thinking about fresh, organic music was an inspiration. And today, mm-hmm. you know, it's a little different thing. It's a lot of people mm-hmm. do a sampling thing. I mean, we wanted to talk about it. A lot of people sample your music. Is that a double-edged sword to you, what the new generation is doing with the old generation's music?
Not as long as I get my check. I'm not mad at them as long as they give me my check. As a matter of fact, I've done a sampling CD, royalty-free, that they can use. It's sold very, very, very well. It's called Soul Treasures. But in terms of, I would just wish, and my hope is that, based on that some of the younger musicians, as opposed to sampling what we did in the past, which has obviously helped us financially, I would hope that they would go back and learn how to create the music from scratch and do it themselves. Kids be getting stuck with jewels or fly gimmicks. Sure to see the action in it, start to mimic. Running to the corner, the dice game is blazing. Looking at the loop, it seems so amazing. The problem is to recreate the vibe. And that vibe is difficult to create because there's a lot of depth that went into that. You know, and there was a lot of nights staying up late, a lot of gigs played late. There's a lot of depth within what they're hearing and the way it was recorded, the whole bit. And that's a little more difficult to recreate with today's equipment and today's mindset. Because most of these young musicians didn't go through the bands we went through. They didn't play those kind of hard times, you know? And that's the difference. And so they're looking for that. But, you know, there's a price to pay for that.
Yes, there is. And, I mean, it was an old school. Art Blakey kind of ran everybody through his school. And now musicians are getting mm-hmm. out of school and they got their own ideas. And they're forging forward without actually having that on-stage school so much.
Yeah, well, just hard to learn it from a record. I mean, you can learn it, but I listened to every Cannonball Adderley record that there was before I joined Cannonball Adderley. But once I joined him, within the first week, I learned more than I did and listen to all those records. Because I was there in the room with him. He could touch me, talk to me, you know. And just the experience of him talking about everybody from Freddie Hubbard to Joe Williams to all the, you know, Nancy Wilson, Sarah Vaughan, like next door neighbors, and sharing these stories with us backstage and us laughing. And I was like a sponge.
Yeah, those stories are, as Diane would say, the fabrics of our lives.
Yes, there you go.
Yeah. So in music, what do you consider a success? Just in general, what's a success in music?
Well, for me, it's not, obviously there's several kinds of successes. There's the financial success of a record, which is one thing, and you hope that you have both a financial success as well as a conceptual and compositional success, and just in terms of a musical success. For me, it's more based in music. Whatever your goal is, if you set out for a particular goal on a particular album, and you reach that goal, or even get close to it, then you're successful. That's kind of how I look at it, especially in jazz, because most jazz records didn't sell a lot of records anyway, so it was never a financial success, unless you were talking about certain Miles Davis records or Train records or certain things that kind of went beyond what people's expectations were. But for jazz, it's always been the case that this is my idea, this is what I want to create, and you go for it, and that's what happens. You know, I think when the whole quote-unquote conceptualization of what smooth jazz became, what it became to be called, you know, in the beginning it was Quiet Storm. It was just, it was me, Stanley Clark, you know, whoever, David Sanborn, and that was, that music that was played on those stations was just a small portion of what we did as artists. Then we were replaced by a whole lot of artists that's all they could do. So the death factor was not there. And so things began to change because, you know, they said, something is missing. Yeah, something is missing. All that baggage and stuff that we carried with us that made us who we were, those guys never went through that. And so now I forgot where I'm going. You know, I'm George. I tend to ramble.
Well, no,
I'm a rambling musician.
That's what we love, man. That's the surface. You're talking about the surface. They don't have, you know, the depth layers of what you went through as musicians, and that, you know, having dinner together, hanging around after the rehearsal, and getting in and sitting and watching each other play those notes and changing things up in the music. That's key, you know. And a lot of people now are just kind of skimming the surface with that.
And also the intent.
Right.
The intent is very important. What the intent of the music was, it had nothing to do with whether it got played in general. They, you know, like Herbie may have done Watermelon Man or Cantaloupe Island, said, I got to do a tune that I can get played on the radio, on jazz radio, blah, 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 because he saw what was happening with Horace Silver, and he said, shoot, I can have one of these too. And so that's okay, but that wasn't the entire focus of the album. Right. There was a lot of music that was more challenging, and that's what's missing in these records today, is that most of these guys, they just do the non-challenging music, and everything else, nobody hears about.
Well, you know where I come from, man. I'm on the road to progression, so I like to hear all that complexion in the music. And so,
I hear you.
So many of these musicians, there's a lot of them that are doing that now, but unfortunately, they're not getting the airplay because the general populace can never get a chance to hear that music because it's not being presented to them.
That's right. Yep, you're absolutely correct. And a lot of musicians are afraid to present it anyway.
This is true.
You know, they're because... takes both. I mean, to say, okay, this is the way I want to do it. Miles, like Miles did. He said, you think you're going to tell Miles what he was going to play?
The reason that I didn't pay any mind to that kind of thing, you know, it was because they thought I was an accident. White people are funny. They, you know, in America, they thought that I just woke up one morning and had the blues and started playing the trumpet.
Now, Miles pretty much had a green card or a white card or whatever that, whatever the one that's the most expensive, the platinum card, he had it.
Good man, get out of my house. You know.
He sure did.
Well, has the change in the music business affected you producing albums in terms of big record deals versus independents having to shop their own music?
Well, absolutely. The change in the business has been dynamic, and it's deep. And I don't know, it's like a bomb going off, and I don't know where the dust is going to settle at this point. But I think it has allowed many of us to become independent as well. I choose to look at the glass being half full as opposed to being half empty. It's kind of like the Wild West. We'll see what's going to happen. As an older producer now, I'm not producing the Ushers and the newer acts and Usher, I mean, those kinds of acts, that's not what I do. I don't get calls for that. So most of the artists that I produced back in the day that were selling records don't even have deals anymore. And if they do, they don't have come with budgets that can afford, even if I lessen my price, they can afford me. So most of the acts that I produce nowadays are from out of the country, because there's still a lot of money out of the country, whether it's Africa, whether it's Russia, Indonesia. That's mostly what I do now, unless there's something I do truly for love, and I said, this has got nothing to do with money. You know, this is something I want to do. For example, the Jeffrey Osborne project record, which I just finished, The Time for Love, That was done for love, man, because I wanted to do that for Jeffrey because he felt it was time for him to do that as an artist. And I said, I'm with you.
Well, yeah, man. You know, we talked once about Russia. I almost had a chance to meet you there for one of your performances. But we talking about Playboy and the Jazz Festival and that party-type atmosphere. Does that exist anywhere else around the world, or is Playboy pretty much the one that has the gigantic party with the music?
No, there are other festivals that kind of are in that area, but it's not quite the same, at least in my opinion. You know, the Playboy is kind of special for, you know, first of all, it's tradition here. And everybody knows what it is, and you're not going there you're almost not going there to hear serious music. You're kind of there. This is a party, you know. So most of the musicians, I think, take it that way. It doesn't mean we don't have fun, but if you're going to do like a Keith Jarrett kind of thing, that ain't the place to play it, you know. And you know what I'm saying? And he's not going to do that, so it's not that kind of thing. But there are other festivals. Montreux Festival is kind of party-like, but they do have their serious moments. Because it's an indoor show, most of it.
Right. Well, let's talk about working with Cousin, man. You introduced me to Diane many, many years ago, and then 2 weeks right after I met her, she was on stage with me at the Monterey Jazz Festival. How's it working with family?
Well, of course, Diane is like one, you know, my favorite. She's like the daughter I never had. She's working on a new album right now with Terrell Carrington, actually. Sounds really good, too. Kind of a little change-up for her. But it sounds real and it sounds organic. And I actually got a chance to play on a little bit of it, along with Esperanza and a few other people.
A change in which direction?
Well, I'd rather her tell you that.
Yeah, okay.
Ah!
I got it. That's all right, cool. We'll talk to her.
But it sounds
too
honest.
Well, honesty is one of the most important things, of course, in the music, as you mentioned. And back in the day, you know, I used to hang with Prince Lachey up in Oakland. And we used to go over to Yoshi's all of the time. And there was a brother named Waleed there. And we brought up your name. He said, George Duke. He said, you asked George about the Both And Club. And so now the last time,
man,
I asked you about that, you laughed and smiled the same way. Man, tell me about the Both And.
Well, see, the Both And Club, that was the big jazz club, especially after the jazz workshop and went away and all of that. And, of course, the Blackhawk had been gone. And it was on a street called Divisadero, which is a couple of blocks, I would say, south of the Half Note Club, which is where I was working with Al Jarreau. Well, all this Miles, you know, Dexter Gordon, whoever came through town, Bobby Hutcherson, who wasn't living there at the time, you know, Joe Henderson, everybody, Cannonball, everybody played there. At this place. So we used to go down there, and especially since we only play on the weekends, they would have acts that started on Tuesday or Wednesday through Sunday. Man, I'd be down there Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, hanging out all night listening to music. And that's how I learned how to play. I was sitting there listening to these guys and got a chance to meet them. And in many cases became like the house band for a lot of the bands that came through, Dexter Gordon being one. So that was that, and I played with Bobby Hutcherson there too back in those days when he didn't want to bring Herbie Hancock or, you know, some of those guys from back east couldn't come. I wound up being like, okay, he's the piano player call in San Francisco. So it was a great club run by a guy named Delano Dean, who's no longer with us, and it was just it was stupid up in there. Let me just put it that way. There was a lot going on in that place. But musically, man, it was a real jazz club. You hear me? A real jazz club.
Yeah, well, man, what a great experience, man. What a great life. You played with so many musicians, you know, and I mean, you speak of cats like Bobby Hutcherson and those, some of the guys that I get a chance to know now. There's so much love with these guys, man. Just so happy to be in their presence and to be able to go on stage and do music together and eat together. It really is it's a wonderful way to be, man. So I'm
proud. It's a family.
Yeah, it definitely is. It definitely is. So, my man, George, I'm proud to know you. You're a beautiful cat, man. Love all of the music, and you've done some extraordinary things in the music. So this is Mr. George Duke. All right. You got it, brother.
So, Leroy, I see you in Russia.
Yeah, man. I wanted to make it there. I didn't make it up there that time. But we'll catch you some other places around the world.
Anytime, man.
Okay.
Anytime. It's your call. Mi casa, su casa.
All right, brother. Well, thank you, man. I've always felt that way, too. So thank you for that.
Sounds good.
Okay, brother.
All right, man.
Look forward to seeing you soon, man.
All right. Take care of yourself.
I'll see you at Playboy. All right. You too, man.
Cool. All right. Later.